everyone, and welcome to the Empathy Podcast. My name's Leanne Butterworth, and today we're talking to Dr. Evan Shaw. Now, what I thought was going to be a discussion about pets ended up being a massive discussion about mental health, about the benefit of pets, but also the financial implications of being a vet, what it's like to be a vet. And also, Dr. Evan Shaw talks about his experience with multiple sclerosis. It's such an engaging discussion. My name's Leanne Butterworth. This is the Empathy Podcast, and today we're talking about empathy and veterinarians with Dr. Evan Shaw. I hope you enjoy. We'll talk to you soon. Bye. Hello, everybody. You're listening to the Empathy Podcast, or the Professional Empathy Podcast now. Today, we're exploring mental health in vets, so in the veterinarian profession. And today, I'm joined by Dr. Evan Shaw. Welcome, Evan. So let's talk for a second about what your background is. So what your professional background is why you got into it.
So I always said from day one, when I was at school, you should never go to uni until you've been 10 years out of school. Because that's like the young point in your life. That's where you can travel everywhere, do everything, you know, don't have kids, don't have, you know, and you can find out and figure out who you are and what you want to do. No 17-year-old walks out of school and goes, I know exactly what I want to do with my life. Like, no one does that. Like, it's crazy. So I went and traveled everywhere. I was a snowboard instructor. I got a record label. I was with Cirque du Soleil for 4 or 5 years. I've been to like 50 countries. I've done a lot. And then basically, hit 28 and went, I always wanted to be a vet. Hit 28 and went, all right, time to, you know, go to vet school and be a vet. So yeah, so did that. And, you know, so now I am a vet. I have a real job, as my mum and dad are so happy about. You know, I'm not doing my music and that stuff. So that was, yeah, so I've done a lot of things, and basically it still came back to every day was all I want to do is work with pets and animals, especially wildlife. My real passion is wildlife, like dogs and cats is, you know, the bread and butter sort of thing, but there's no money in wildlife, so you've got to do other things to do that. So, yeah, that's my sort of my real passion is wildlife. But, yeah, that was my sort of like my upbringing and stuff. It was all very you do what you want, when you want and how you want, being very supported in, you know, whatever decision. And Dad always said, you know, like if you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life. So that's been a pretty strong thing, you know, for me growing up. Both my parents sort of instilled, you know, it's not like, you know, what you have and, you know, doesn't mean crap. Who you are and how happy you are is what means something.
Yeah. And I think we're all sort of feeling that a little bit more at the moment in terms of it really doesn't matter what car is stuck in the carport or in the garage. Doesn't matter what heels I have in the cupboard, what cool jewelry you have. None of that matters right now.
That matters. And everybody's worked out very quickly just how little a lot of things mean.
I'm also finding it's easier to ask people how they are, like whoever they are in the world.
Oh, yeah.
Because I can go, how are you? And people genuinely know that you're interested in the answer. At the moment, if I message my friend in Finland and go, how are you? You're genuinely listening for the answer. And they're not just fobbing you off.
Yeah. It's not a courtesy anymore. It's an actual question.
Yeah.
Like, how are you doing? How are you? Great. Like, what do you, how's things been? Busy. That answer has gone. The busy to me is like the laziest answer in the world. How is it? I was really busy. But now it's very different. Like, how you been? Oh, this. And you don't feel bad about saying it. Like, does this person really want to know? Most people are. I just want to hear a voice. Like, I just want to have an interaction. Like, I want to, people are genuinely like, how are you? And I love it. Like, because I'm very, very, very mental health aware, have been for quite some time, especially with, so a lot of people don't know that I actually have multiple sclerosis. So I, you know, like with brain scarring and stuff like that, you do have some sort of, you know, emotional, you know, and physiological things going on in your head where you just get scars, you forget shit, you know, and stuff like that. And depending on, you know, attacks and stuff like that, your mental health is very, very important. And it's really, really, really pushed for people with multiple sclerosis and quite a few disabilities. The mental health aspect is really, really important, where a lot of people see the physical, they don't understand the mental. And especially with someone in my condition, you can't see the physical.
Yeah.
So everyone thinks I'm fine. Everyone thinks I'm fine. And then they find out, they're like, oh, you qualified for the Paralympics? What the hell? And I'm like, yeah, because of this. And they go like, oh, my God, like, but you play rugby. Like sort of thing. I'm like, yeah, I know. Doesn't mean, you know, I'm not, just because I'm not in a wheelchair doesn't mean I don't have MS sort of thing. Because, yeah, there's a whole, and yeah, and I really, really try and push that whole mental health thing. It's sort of one of those things that now I do really appreciate that mental health has taken such a huge, because of all everything going on with Corona, it's taken a huge front seat. Everyone's now really understanding, like, oh, this is a thing. And even after 2 weeks, everybody started feeling like, I don't feel right. It's like, yeah, like, welcome to our world, like, all the time. Yeah, it's good. It's just nice to see that everybody is starting to understand how the other half live.
Sort of and especially like you just said, it's confronting, it's getting people to confront their own stigma and their own judgment to sort of go, well, like assuming you should be fine, assuming people who are at home should be fine, assuming that, I'd be fine, but to actually be confronted with, oh, hang on. And it's, again, that empathy of, oh, hang on, people who are dealing with Centrelink aren't just trying to rot the system. Centrelink's actually hard. Staying at home is actually hard. Being at home with your kids and homes, like trying to teach them stuff and parent and make snacks and also do your work and also it's actually really hard. So it would make perfect sense then. So for people to come to the realization, it would make perfect sense given what we're going through, given the level of stress that I would struggle or that anyone would struggle with their mental health. And that there are lots of services out there at the moment.
Yeah, there's heaps. There's a lot. And especially living in Australia, like a hell of a lot of them are free. So, I always tell everybody, I was like, I basically say, so who's your clinical psychologist? And everyone goes, I don't have one of them. I'm like, cool. Do you have a dentist? Yeah. Do you have a physio? Yeah. You got a GP? Yeah. Yeah. Cool. So the most important thing, your headspace, why don't you have a doctor for that? Yeah, and they're just like, oh, no, because there's just that stigma of, oh, no, no, yeah. But if you get, I've always found that, you know, if you have, like, especially in my industry, I was, like, the oldest in my class, like for the guys and stuff. And a lot of the guys, you know, 17, 18-year-old guys who are all, you know, country boys and, like, all this stuff, you know, yeah, rah-rah boys and stuff. And for the first sort of year, they were, like, a bit, oh, you know, what's all this? You know, oh, yeah, my feelings are fine. Like, why do you want to talk about feelings and rah, 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 rah and stuff? And then I've always pushed that, being like, hey, guys, you've got to be really on top of this. You're going to be in this, you know, crazy environment for the next 6 years, being retardedly stressed, living with the same people. You're not going to have any money because you're not going to be able to work because you're going to study, like, and all you've got to travel everywhere. You've got to do all these things. Like, you need to start getting on top of this stuff, like, now. And then after sort of like second, third year, people were just like, oh, wow, like this is really important. And it's not something that you can't talk about, but you need people out there who are willing to talk about it and not be scared about it and not feel like for ages. You know, I didn't want to talk about anything like that because everything's fine. I'm a man, totally fine. Everything's all good. Yeah. And then like, you know, I started working out, especially with, you know, MS and stuff like that. I noticed things happening. And you know, being a veterinarian, and I was like, oh, I really actually like the physiological things behind it and why these things happen. So I started doing a lot of research into like why these sort of different situations happen and chemical things in the brain, like all that sort of stuff. And it really started to interest me and just how much work you could do on it without medication, without, you know, all those sorts of things, just talking to people, improving, you know, your relationships and stuff. Yeah, it's nice that it's starting to lose so much stigma. So many more people are actually just being able to say, I'm not doing well. Like, I'm not doing well is such a much harder answer than I'm fine.
Oh, gotcha. And I think that's now half of the conversation, and I'm trying to plan the other half of the conversation is teaching people how to listen. Because if nobody's ever really been speaking up, then nobody knows how to listen. And that's sort of what I'm finding a lot is everybody kind of goes, eek, I don't know what to do with this. Yeah. You should just talk to a counsellor, or I'm not the right person to talk to, not realising that their value is in giving that person
the listening,
audience.
Not the answer. It's not the answer.
No.
That's the thing. Most people aren't looking for an answer. They actually don't want an answer.
Exactly.
They don't need an answer. They don't want an answer. They're annoyed by an answer. Sort of thing. It's just like, no, just sit there and nod your head and go, yep. That sucks. I'm really sorry you're going through that. That really sucks. I can't, you know, one of the other things, you know, people are like, oh, yeah, I know how you feel. No, you don't.
No.
Like, just sit there and listen. Like, just sit there and like and know that you don't know how they feel, because everyone's different.
Yeah. And the damage making someone feel dismissed as well, because if they feel dismissed by you, they're never telling you anything ever again.
No.
And they may not tell anybody else. They may not feel comfortable to tell anybody else either. So that's basically my entire business is trying to teach people how to listen with empathy, so that when all these wonderful people who go, you know what, I think I'm ready to speak up, they're actually met with love, and they're met with that compassion and a set of ears who goes, oh, sweetheart, that's awful. I've no idea what to say, but let's figure it out.
That sucks. Like, just having someone hear that is generally 10 times better than, oh, what you should just do this.
Yeah.
What you should do is, like, that's the most annoying thing. Like, oh, you're depressed? Oh, just don't be.
Just don't be depressed. You know? Oh, I have that too.
Go for a jog. Like, you
know. You should just have a drink.
Oh, that's my favorite. Oh, you broke up with your girlfriend? Let's go out and get drunk. It's like, let's go and have, like, a whopping amount of a depressant. That's a great idea.
Oh, we speak the same language. So let's talk about vets for a second. What's it like? So you said that wildlife vets was a bit of a calling.
I was the kid that had birds in shoe boxes and, you know, injured birds in down the park in shoe boxes and rats and mice that he'd found somewhere, or, you know, those sorts of things. Or, oh, the cat brought in a half dead rat. I'm going to try and fix it. like lots of birds, lots of wildlife. Used to spend, I lived next to Lone Pine Koala Sanctuary. We actually had a secret entrance into Lone Pine, and we used to go there like every second day and just go around. One of our mates, she worked in the cafeteria, and so she was in charge of all the kangaroo food.
Yeah.
So we used to go like every Saturday, Sunday, we'd break into Lone Pine and just feed all the animals and just buggerize around with all the animals. So I loved
it's a beautiful place.
Yeah.
Being a vet, like, has it lived up to your expectations?
Yes and no. There's so many misnomers about veterinary, about being a vet. Even though it's a lot harder to be a vet than it is to be a human doctor, we're the redheaded stepchildren of the medical world, because they're like, oh, you just do animals. So for people, there's one set of parameters.
Yep.
That's it. For animals, there's like even just the basal temperature of a cat is completely different to a dog, that's completely different to a horse, completely different to a goat, completely different to a... So you need to know all these parameters.
Yep.
And then once you start throwing pharmacology in there, this one set of medication will fix, you know, will cure the cat's cancer. If you gave it to a dog, it'll make its hair fall out. If you gave it to a horse, it's going to de-sex it. If you gave it to, like, it all has different reactions in all these different animals.
Yeah.
So you've got to remember all the different pharmacologies for... And once you start getting the difference between reptiles and mammals. They're a cold-blooded and warm-blooded animal. Yeah. That is like an alien and a person, you know, sort of thing. Like, they're these wildly different sets of, like, stuff you need to know. Yeah, so it's really good in the sense of I'm helping. I can do something. The first sort of year, 2 years, it's very scary because you see a lot of pain, death, hurt, you know, all these things. But because you're not trained, you don't know what to do. So you feel really helpless and it's very difficult. And then once you start getting good, which is like sort of halfway through fourth year, and you start understanding disease processes and stuff like that, your whole mindset changes to, oh, my God, I can help.
Yeah.
Like, this injured bird, and I'm just standing there just going, like, what do I do? It's it's now like, oh, no, no, this bird needs heat, needs this, got to do this, you know, a bit of water, rah, 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 and, you know, everyone else is panicking, going, oh, this bird, this possum can't do this. And you just pick it up and go, yeah, it's this thing, isn't it? Put it in the thing, and there we go. You're warm, sorted. Yeah. And you feel like, oh, it's not scary anymore. It's not terrifying. I can do something. And your self-worth goes through the roof.
And I suppose the other difference is that the animals can't tell you what hurts.
Yeah, my throat hurts. It's just, yeah. So, like, generally we get, you know, the dog comes in. And so you'll notice there's a huge difference between what you'll experience in a veterinary clinic and what you'll experience in a GP's clinic. So we talk a lot more. We ask 1,000 more questions than a GP does because we can't ask the patient.
Yeah.
So we have a very different process to how. So if you walk into a GP clinic, I don't know the last time that I can't remember the last time someone took my pulse rate, my temperature, listened to my lung fields, listened to my heart. And did like a full body, like, you know, checked my ears, checked my eyes, checked my nose, checked my mouth, checked my bum, checked my, all those sorts of things.
Yeah.
Every time you go to a vet clinic, that's what happens.
Yeah.
And every time I go to a human clinic, I sit there and I literally critique them while they're doing it. Be like, why, I'm experiencing this and this and this. Why wouldn't you listen to my lung fields immediately? This is clearly an upper respiratory tract infection. I'd like to have that confirmed, and I'm really sure I'm going to need these antibiotics for it too, sort of thing. And like a lot of the time they're like, yep, here you go. But yeah, I've found because a lot of, they just don't have the time, you know, they're a 10-minute slot. So it's what's wrong here? Here's a prescription.
Yeah.
Go fix it with this. Where in animal medicine, there's we do have to do things a lot different. So because 50% of our job is food, right? Everything, like 50% of stuff that we look after in vet school, you're going to eat one day. So all the cattle, okay, gotcha. Or the chickens, or the pork, or all that stuff, that's literally 50% of a veterinary degree is livestock.
Yeah.
So we do kind of sit there and like have a very different view of like the whole process. And because we have all this livestock and the stuff like that, we can't use medicine because we're going to eat it. So we're not allowed to use antibiotics. We're not allowed to use steroids. We're not allowed to use all these things. So we have a much, much, much bigger amount of training in like nutrition, in what's called in environmental enrichment, like all of these things, like because we can't give these animals stuff, we've got to cure them via how they feel in the head and how they feel in their guts. And they're unbelievably linked to your mental health and an animal's mental health. Like 95% of your serotonin is made in your guts, not in your head. Yeah. 90% of your dopamine's made in your guts, not in your head. Like, and that's why gut health is so important to veterinarians, because that's how we cure a lot of things and a lot of diseases is, oh, this is happening. Oh, because they're eating this or too much of this or too little of this. They don't have the room to move. They don't have an ability to represent the five freedoms of being an animal, like all these sorts of things. Not, oh, we'll just throw medicine at it.
So then where does empathy then play in to... Because, I mean, you've just said that you've got to look at the environment, you've got to look at the nutrition and all that sort of stuff. Where does empathy play into the life of a vet? Because you would think that you've got so many different, I mean, you've got a creature here of some description that needs something. You've got an owner and you'd think that the owners would have very different investment. Oh, God, yeah. So what, and then I'm assuming not everybody comes in going, please do whatever it takes.
Oh, no, everyone comes in saying that. Everyone comes in saying that. Two favorite lines, do whatever it takes. Money is not an option. As soon as you say that, I'm going to demand a deposit on the spot, because you're the person who doesn't have any money and you're the person who doesn't have any time and doesn't want to do anything. And 50% of people will come in and say, money is not, I don't care, rah, rah, I'm like, cool, I need to do this, this, and this, and it's going to cost like $900. Rah, what the hell? Like, like, don't you love animals? Like, you should be doing this for free. Like,
oh,
basically, well, that's like an astronomical part of a vet's day is spent being abused by clients. An astronomical proportion of your day is being spent being abused by clients, whether it be to your face, whether it be online, whether it be to the nurse about you at the front desk, whether it be
purely dollars, or is it?
Most of the time it's dollars. A couple of things. One, very stressful situations a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Very stressful situations. So you're just like, I don't know what to do. So there's a bit of panic going on and stuff like that. And I understand those situations. Number, the absolute biggest problem we have in this country with veterinary medicine by a long, long way is no one in this country has any clue of what medicine costs.
No. Because we have free healthcare.
Exactly. So everybody goes, so a lot of people you get is a, oh, but if I go to the doctor, it's free. It's like, yeah, cool, that's for you. Your tax dollars paid. The really good thing about having a brother who's a pediatric surgeon is a 30-kilo Rottweiler and a 30-kilo kid are exactly the same thing, almost. So we'll use the same plates, the same drugs, the same anesthesia, very, very similar post-surgical drugs, very similar post-surgical physiotherapies and all those sorts of things. And I say to a lot of people, look, how much for a 30-kilo Rottweiler? Standard is the broken arm, like a humeral fracture.
Yeah.
Broken arm for a Rottweiler, exact same break in a 30-kilo child.
Yeah.
How much would you expect to fix that break in the dog? How much would you expect to pay? Yeah, so you have $2,000
yeah.
sort of thing. So, yeah, we'll do it for about $2,000. What do you think costs the Australian health system to fix that same break in a 30-kilo child?
Significantly more, I would think.
It's about $58,000. So we do that using the same drugs, the same thing, the same expertise, the same lot. We do it for $2,000-$2,500. The Australian government will do it for about $58,000.
Yeah,
that's what it costs. That's what medicine costs. Like people go, oh, there's exorbitant prices in the US. And you're like, no, that's just what medicine costs.
Yeah.
Like that's what it is. So, yeah, so unfortunately people don't understand that.
Gotcha.
People think that vets are rich. A veterinary degree is the second lowest earning degree of any degree at university. It is also the most expensive.
Yeah.
The median wage. Yeah, the median wage for a vet in Australia is $64,000. So that's a vet with 10 years experience. My sister is a police officer. She was on more than that after 6 months of police school.
Yeah.
Academy work. So, yeah, so we spend, like my degree cost me almost $100,000.
Yeah.
And my graduating wage is $44,000.
Yeah. So then is that why a lot of vets... I mean, yes, there's the financial.
Have a terrible car. Yes.
Have a crappy car.
Yeah.
But also then if you're running a practice, that would be that financial stress, not only of the income, but also of running a practice in an environment where people don't pay bills, where you've got lots of regulation, where you've got high rent.
Huge amounts of consumables, high staff costs, huge amounts of consumables. But the big thing is people just don't pay their bill. So most vet clinics that my mates work at or own, most of them lose, like have about $300,000 to $500,000 a year in unpaid bills. Like astronomical amounts. And people wonder why vets go, I'm not going to do anything until I get a deposit. I can't help you. It's because every single person goes, oh, but I'm good for it. And a lot of the time they're not, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And we get stuck with the bill.
Yeah.
And then because we've done this, they then go online and tell everybody how much of a terrible person I am and how I don't care about animals. I only care about money. It's like, no. You literally asked me to put my hand into my pocket, take $1,000 of my own money out and pay for the health of your pet.
Yeah.
Because I love animals. Because, yeah.
I mean, I had to make that decision. I mean, I had Gina. Yeah. I adopt X-Racing Greyhounds. And Gina got...
Nice. Good work. They're great dogs.
Oh, I love them.
They're such stoic animals.
Oh, my God. Gina was like a cat. She was like this black cat walking around. And Harry's like a toddler. Yeah.
They're so lovely. They are really lovely dogs.
But I had to make that decision. Gina got osteosarcoma in her shoulder and they said, look, we had 6 weeks for a bit of a limp to, sorry, Gina. But they said, look, you can amputate and do radiation and you're looking down the barrel of $10,000 and you might get an extra 3 months out of it. And we sort of had to go, and that's a gut-wrenching decision. Yeah. But if I was...
Well, it's not like the way that I have to look at it is this. Like a lot of people look at it as time. I look at it and go, like, my big thing for animals and stuff like that is quality of life.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why we made the decision that we made. Sorry.
And in people medicine, like my brother being an emergency, he runs, he's an emergency pediatrician in Brisbane, but he also runs the entire emergency department at Lismore General.
Okay.
So he works with a lot of old people down there as well. So he's got, he's always said to me, and it's very, very true, for most people, the last 2 to 3 months of your life are horrendous, full of pain, sickness, and you just want to die. But everybody around you wants to keep you alive, and everybody around you wants to do whatever you can to save grandma. And a lot of the time he sits there and goes, like, no, grandma's told me like 12 times she really wants to die.
She's
like, doesn't matter. Like, you do whatever you can. Yeah. And if you don't, you're an asshole sort of thing. So I'm really happy that euthanasia is starting to be brought into human medicine because the last 2 months of your life is the most expensive. By normally a factor of 10 because of the medication and all the stuff that you need, the hospital attendance and all those sorts of things. So the last 2 months of anybody's life is the most expensive point of their life for the government, for them, for anything. Just for the huge amounts of the palliative care you need. And it sucks. It sucks for a lot of people that last month or 2 months. It really sucks. So euthanasia is a fantastic thing. We've had it in veterinary medicine, so that's hopefully going to change those sorts of things. And the whole mental aspect of, no, we've got to keep everybody alive.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, no, like, there's sometimes you've just got to go and ask Nan, because 99% of the time Nan's like, please let me go. Yeah.
They said, like, with Gina, because it was in her shoulder, we would have essentially had to fillet the dog. She would have had to learn to walk again on three legs for three.
And osteosarc is, an amputation and drugs and everything. It's a death sentence, unfortunately. And even if you take the leg off and do all that stuff, get really early, 6 months.
Yeah.
If you do every, like, 3 months, maybe, if you do nothing.
Yeah.
6 months if. And the other thing is, it is horrendously painful.
Yeah, she was not a happy girl.
you're sick, and it's literally like your bones are on fire. So it's one of those things that, like, what you did was fantastic. So you gave the dog a really good life, and then when shit started to go downhill, and it was definitely going to get a lot worse.
Oh yeah,
who would want to go through that? No. Who would want to have that as the last?
So then my poor vet, so I have Shane the vet, and Shane was in tears when
because I don't work in clinic anymore, thank God, I work for rescue, but I used to spend at least 2 or 3 days a week either coming home in tears or tears in the consult because I'd lost something, I'd lost a dog, or just the whole, I had to put someone's dog down today, and I've looked after that dog for the last 3 years.
Yeah.
And the dog's awesome. And now it's just, so we take monumental amounts of it home with us.
Yeah.
Like, people think, oh, you just cut it off, and you just, no, we do not.
So then where does abuse play? So you've got abuse from patients. You've got financial stress. Yeah. You've got having to put down animals that I'm sure in rescues, quite possibly healthy animals too.
That's the reason why I'd much prefer rescue, is because there's no people, there's no humans.
Yeah, okay.
Everything for me was coming from clients, people.
Yeah, okay.
The animals are great. If you just got to deal with the animals, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Because I'm looking after the animal, the animal's probably got a 95% chance of getting better, because I know it's going to get the medication it needs each time, each day, and all these sorts of things. It's getting the right food, it's getting weighed, it's getting this stuff. You tell someone their cat's got or dog's got diabetes and they've got to give an injection every 12 hours, and they're just like, oh, that's too hard sort of thing. And then the dog comes back 3 weeks later with, crashing and stuff like that. It's like, oh, I forgot to do this, and I didn't do this, and I didn't. It's like, well,
my mum's dog has diabetes, and she said giving the injection, she's doing it like religiously.
Well, you have to. You have to give it exactly the same time every 12 hours.
She's on top of it. Like, she knows it. Yeah. She's on all the Facebook pages.
Some clients are fantastic. And they're the ones that keep us going. Clients like your mum are the ones that keep us going. But there's probably, for me, in my experience, only about 20% of owners are like that. Yeah. Everyone claims they love their dog and love their cat. But if you need them to do, when it's convenient, and if you need, like, my absolute favorite thing is the ridiculous amounts of dogs and cats that are in Australia that are overweight. Stop feeding your dog. Like, stop feeding. Like, and I'll still to this day, I'll never forget the one conversation that I had with a guy. And this is pretty indicative of what happens and how much you're lied to. Like, you know, like I lie to my doctor.
Yeah.
You know, you're eating right, you're exercising. Shit, yes, of course. Sir. Of course I am. How dare you question that?
Yeah.
And it's the exact same. I understand, like, why people do it when they come into the vet. So you're doing this, good. Yep. Giving you parasiticides every. Yep, definitely. Yeah, it's on the thing. And it does this, and no. Like, that's not what's been going on. Like, clearly your dog is huge. You're definitely only giving it, and yeah, like, you'll write them out a whole dietary plan of this and this and this. And this is a classic example with. Guy came in, wife and the guy, I see they go like, oh, yeah. I was like, this dog is huge. Like, dog needs to be half the size. Like, and you've got to be very, you know, gentle about, like, oh, you know, someone's been having snacks sort of thing. Like, oh, we do need to shave a bit of that off, you know, because later on, but really you just want to sit there and be like, why are you feeding your dog pies? Like, and clearly so many of them.
Because he likes the pies.
Oh, because he likes them. Sort of thing. So there's a fantastic app now, which basically what it does is you take the breed of the dog, the age and the sex of the dog, and then put in their weight, and it will render for you what that dog would look like if it was a person in their underwear. And it freaks people out. That's because there'll just be this big, giant, fat dude like standing there going, this is what your dog would look like if it was a human. That's the thing that really hammers home, like, oh my God, if my dog was a person, they'd look like that.
So then, because that would be, you would think, a form of abuse as well. So how did
it is?
How do it is. Vets it's wrap not, their head around the is. Abuse side of things, like seeing it and taking it on board and seeing what humans are capable of? Like, because to me, that seems horrific as well. Or is that less?
Well, you don't really see a lot of it. If you work in clinic, you don't see a lot of it. If you work in rescues like I do, you see it all the time. So I'm actually currently doing my crime scene processing and animal forensics course at the moment for specifically this. So I do a fair bit of anti-poaching stuff in South Africa and also in Australia as well with wildlife. And the trading of wildlife has become quite ripe in Australia as well.
Yeah.
So there's now actually Sydney Uni does courses for veterinarians in crime scene processing and animal welfare cases and stuff like that, which I'm currently doing at the moment. But in, like, you can have an inkling every now and then of, yeah, that dog's been kicked. That dog didn't fall down. That dog didn't fall down the staircase. That dog been kicked.
Yeah.
But it's actually really rare. Because the other thing is, if someone kicks their dog or something like that, they're not going to take it to the vet because they're going to go, the vet's going to know. They're the dogs that you come in, that you have come in 2 years later with a limp. And they're like, oh, what happened there? Oh, yeah, like years ago. He's always had that sort of thing. So, yeah, but at the end of the day, it is very rare that I would have, like, during clinic, that I sat there and went, this could be a welfare case.
Yeah,
I'm talking like maybe once a month max out of the 300 dogs you'd see in a month, maybe one of them.
Yeah, so what do you really guys know. At uni, because you said that you guys talk about it a little bit, that you as a mature age student at 28, isn't that glorious? 28, I remember the 26-year-old being the mature age student. So is this becoming part of a course of things like compassion and mental health and self-care and communication and human emotions? Is that part of a vet's course? Because by the sound of it,
yes, it is definitely. But it's very misguided. Like, it's very, you know, get people in to do workshops.
Yeah,
like,
gotcha.
Once every sort of couple of months, we'd have these people coming in. Hey, we're going to do this. They're not vets and stuff. They're people who go to, like, corporate meetings and stuff like that, do a Myers-Briggs test on you. Like,
gotcha.
Yeah, so that side of thing, like, we do a lot of role-playing consults. They actually hire actors and bring them in.
Yeah.
And you don't know what's going to walk through the door, and you're filmed and all of these sorts of things. So there is quite a lot, but the whole mental health thing I found an absolute joke, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
I had a very bad experience with a couple of my lecturers because of my, I had MS and I don't tell people because people judge me. So I actually had two of my lecturers whilst I was going through uni tell me that I was basically a shitty person for doing veterinary science with MS, and I'd taken the position because, you know, 5,000 people apply for 50 spots at the university. Huh. As far as they was concerned, I'd taken an able-bodied person's position who could have been a much better vet.
Oh, Jesus.
Or has the better potential to be a better vet. And it was my absolute delight and pleasure on the graduation day to walk into one of their offices, throw my degree in front of him and go, look, 6 years, not a single failed part.
Yeah,
never failed an exam, never failed an assignment, never failed anything.
Yeah.
50% of the vet class fails something. 50% of the vet class will fail something during that 6 years. I didn't fail a thing.
Yeah.
And I was just like, here you go. Then, vets, people who get into vet school and medicine and stuff, generally are real alphas.
Yeah, okay.
Especially, like, the girls as well are real alphas. So they're quite strong, you know, like, you know, oh, this is what I'm going to do, you know, like decision-making sort of thing. So it's quite difficult in a world where you're really competing against each other because you're living day and night with each other, 10 hours a day, 5-6 days a week. For 6 years, there is a lot of competition. And you can't have weak, you can't show weakness. You can't talk about it's difficult. It's like, no, man, you've got to be, you know, it's like, oh, no, I'm killing these exams. It's like, no, you're not. No one is. No one in the class got a HD on that last exam. Two people got a distinction. That's it. Everybody else got passes and credits. Like, you didn't kill that. Like, just stop. Yeah, like, it's okay to... You know, not be like, I hate horses because I suck at them. I have no qualms about saying, like, you put a horse in front of me and I will look at it and go, please don't kill me, please don't kill me, please don't kill me. Like, it's okay to have those sorts of things. We had a guy who was terrified of cats. He was 6'5", built like a brick shit house, terrified of cats. But he wasn't allowed to show it because everyone would make fun of him.
So then, if we're not really covering, mental health effectively at university,
let's use this as
our platform. What is it that you want vets to know, who need to take care of their mental health, aren't really given the skills and tools and training to do so? What is it that you would have them know?
First of all, prepare them. Like, there is so much of what people think being a vet is and the reality.
Gotcha.
The reality, like, for people, is like, I'm going to be a doctor. I'm going to have a stethoscope. Everyone's going to love me because I'm going to be able to fix their pet. Everyone's going to be, and it's going to be so good. I'm going to play with cats and dogs all day and stuff like that. And yeah, like, you get paid, and it's just not that. It's not that at all. It's the other big thing that I really, 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 really think is so important for vets, especially, is I did one lecture in business at university for veterinary science. Most clinics run themselves. Nobody in the whole of 6 years, we were not allowed to bill someone. We weren't allowed to make a bill, and we weren't allowed to charge someone. That was for the girls on the front desk, because we weren't allowed to do that because we're just students.
Yeah, okay.
So we never learnt how to bill someone, how to write up a bill, how to talk to someone about a bill. How to talk to someone about, we can try this. If you've only got this much money, we can try these things.
Yeah.
We were taught gold standard everywhere. you do this or you don't do it at all sort of thing. Like, this is the gold standard. Like, that's what you have to be taught.
Yeah.
That's not the reality of any situation. Like, most things in veterinary science are fixed, you know, fixed with a toothpick and a roll of duct tape because people don't have the money.
Yeah.
I found that nobody has a clue about business. Like, I was doing my MBA whilst I was doing my, in my final year of vet school, and everyone thought I was insane. I was like, you guys have no idea how much 50% of your job is literally going to be balancing the books, not the medicine.
And also talking to insurance companies and
anything like that. The veterinary surgeons board, salespeople, pharmacological bloody changes, like all the gear you've got to buy.
Yeah. Human resources.
Like all these sorts of things. Human, like everything like this. Like, the vet owns the vet clinic and so many of them have no idea how to run a business. So, yeah, I just found it really strange that the most important thing, and they're all independent businesses, like now you're getting big corporate, you know, Green Cross and BSA and stuff like that, but still 50% of vet clinics are privately owned. And they're doing all their own books.
I guess the first thing is, so being prepared for vets, that's probably the best piece of advice. Is there anything that vets, apart from knowing their business, can do in terms of their own mental health?
Oh, like have a holiday, have a day off. Like, it's the amount of vets and stuff that I was like, when is the last time you have left the house for longer than 24 hours and not taken your phone? Do that tomorrow. Go and do it tomorrow.
Yeah.
Like, they're constantly waiting for that on call, that email, someone's dog's sick. That they can't let go. Because we do bring a lot of it home with us and we think about it during the day, and then, you know, we've got to do case write-ups at the end. Like, you come home, you might have 3 or 4 case write-ups you didn't finish at work.
Yeah.
So you're bringing it home with you and you're remembering that stuff, and then there's an email and stuff. And I'm just, like, constantly telling people, I know it's difficult because we don't earn a lot of money. Take holidays.
Yeah.
You're allowed to take a break. You don't, like, the amount of people, vets, who think they have to be there all the time. They have to do everything for the dog. They have to, It's like, no, you're allowed to delegate. And they're also really worried as well, as that person isn't going to do as good a job as me because I'm the vet. Like, we have some absolutely fantastically qualified vet nurses in Australia who are exceedingly capable in doing a lot of things. And a lot of vets are, no, you can't do that. Like, I've got to do that because, you know, and they're worried about things, you know, that'll come back to me, and if you do that and you stuff up. It's like, no, like, you need to let go of the reins.
Yeah.
Especially after you leave school, because you're hammered with whole, oh, it's going to be your fault if you're the vet on the thing, if you're the vet in charge, if you're the vet, it's all yours. But, like, it's, there's all this finger waving, and everyone's so scared of a bad Facebook review that, it's just, there's just these pointless things that you don't need to worry about in the whole scheme of things, and it destroys their mental health long term. Yeah, so I'm like, take a break. Don't have a Facebook page. Like, so many companies, like, oh, no, I've got to have one. I'm like, why? How many people are going onto Facebook to find a vet clinic? They're Googling. Have an Instagram account. Put up pretty pictures. Don't have things where people can review you, and you know that they're in a highly charged situation. They're going to give you a bad review because they're angry and upset that something's happened to their dog and they can't fix the problem immediately. So, get off Facebook. You don't need to have all this other stuff. It's just, it's have a break. Just have a break, please. Have a break.
And it's giving yourself
permission to
be a human as well as a vet, and not wrapping up all of your identity in being a vet. You're allowed to be Evan, who just goes and doesn't talk vet, doesn't think vet, doesn't just goes and does something else, whatever. And I guess it's that having different hobbies and different interests.
Yeah, you need, like, desperately. Like, I have a record label. Like, music is my thing. Like, I work for Blues Fest. I've got during this whole time, a bunch of my bands, you know, none of them have got jobs.
Yeah.
Two lead singers live with me now. Because I was like, what else are you going to do?
Yeah.
So they're helping me doing a lot of my filming and stuff, like my upcoming videos and stuff for the websites and all those sorts of things and stuff. But, like, I, every single afternoon, like, I walk into the music studio and I'll play piano for half an hour. Yeah. I'll sit down with one of my singers and record him singing like something completely different.
Yeah.
Like I've got a really good woodworking shed downstairs. You need these outlets that just a lot of vets are just like, no, there's so much study to do. There's all these things to do. And I've got all these cases I've got to write up by tomorrow and
And it's
I'm really
that
busy.
Self-compassion as well. I mean, you can give and give and give to the pets and the owners and the lawyer. It's having that self-compassion. Go, no.
Yeah. Compassion fatigue is huge problem for vets is compassion fatigue.
Yeah.
And then they come home and they're like, I don't want to listen to my wife's problems right now. I've listened to four different people cry in my clinic today. One of them abused me and then I had to put the dog down. And now my wife wants to come home and, you know, she's annoyed about Karen from HR sort of thing. Where it's something that's really important to my wife, but it's like I just don't have the capacity right now to just, I'm full. I'm full. Like,
Because you would be a better vet, you would think, if you practice self-care, gave yourself that compassion, if you were operating at a level of control and of relaxation, you would be a better vet with greater empathy and
wildly better. Like I know guys who are doing, you know, 70-80 hour weeks and they're kind of horrible people because that's just what they're doing. Like they're just tired all the time. You know, they haven't had 8 hours of sleep in 5 years, you know, sort of thing. Like all these sorts of things. And you just kind of sit there going like, and I don't have any qualms about telling someone they're turning into an asshole. Because I think that's something that people are very scared of. Because what do you think of me? It's like, dude, look, I've just noticed like you're turning into an asshole. But like, you know, I've just noticed you do get quite aggravated quite quickly and I'm worried about you.
If you're always operating on a level of risk mitigation and ego, like that's gotta be exhausting. Yeah.
And that's the thing, like everybody, like you can't diagnose every problem. Most problems take, you know, a couple of things to do to like, and there's this real expectation of I should be able to do one test and know what's wrong with this dog. I should be able to do a blood test and look at the blood test. And because in uni, we just, you know, we had all these things. You went through the blood test and went, oh, this is down, this is up, this is, dogs don't read textbooks. That's my most important thing that I try and tell people is like, what you learn at uni is new through like a lot of, this is what this disease looks like sort of thing. Like, there's just so much of like life happens outside and it doesn't follow any rule book. Like this
and
is.
It's also getting rid of that, my favourite word, which is it should respond to this, it should look like this, I should do this, I should achieve this, I should know this, I should study this.
One of the little tidbits I try and tell a lot of vets is, and a lot of doctors this as well because they don't actually know it, I say, how many people in Australia die from aspirin or paracetamol each year? It's about 300 a year die from paracetamol. Yep. And in Victoria last year, there were 3,900 hospital admissions.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay.
Overdose of paracetamol and stuff. That's the thing. And you sit there and you go, nothing is safe. So, like, that's the thing. Like, you can give a dog this drug and the dog might die.
Yeah.
But you read the body, you're like, no, it doesn't say anything about, like, but that's just what happened to that dog. It was just something. Yeah. So, this whole sort of, it's just like bad things happen. Yeah. You're never going to. Get some, like a lot of things you're just never going to diagnose. God, it took me, like it took some of my friends 10 years to get diagnosed with MS. 10 years of countless hospital doctor visits, those sorts of things. Yeah. Most MS cases take about 3 to 4 years to diagnose. I was just really lucky that when it happened to me, I just happened to walk into a doctor's office who I'd never been to before. I had my normal doctor. He was sick. Yeah. I walked into my doctor's office. It was an old regional dude in Brisbane at like this big giant clinic. Never met him in my life. And he went, poke, poke, poke. Picked up the phone and went, I'm calling you an ambulance. Oh. I was like, huh? And he was like, I think you're demyelinating. You could stop breathing in like the next 10 minutes.
Wow.
Sort of thing. I was like, huh? He thought what I had was a lot worse.
Yeah.
But I went to hospital that night. He literally had it picked straight away. I had at least 15 doctors come and look at me and not have a clue what's wrong. And it took me and my brother sitting next to me and me going, the doctor said this here. I've been Googling demyelination.
Yeah.
I think I could have MS. My brother walked outside, went to one of the desks. The doctor who trained him was outside. She just happened to be like Queensland's top neurosurgeon.
Yeah.
She walked in and went, poke, poke, poke. Now give him an MRI. We'll find out what happens. Came upstairs and she was like, yep, you got it, MS.
Oh.
Yeah. I was really, 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 really lucky that I had that doctor who just demyelinating. Yeah. Who just, because he was like, I've seen this once before.
So then let's quickly, for our millions of listeners, what are the benefits? Because I've just seen recently there's been a spike in people adopting pets.
Yep.
We
ran out of dogs at the RSPCA.
Did you really?
Yeah. So we have the largest, out of Wacol is the largest, what's called rescue centre in the Southern Hemisphere. It's about $30 million worth.
Yeah.
We have enough room out there for about 800 dogs, about 400 cats and a bunch of other animals.
Yeah.
Most of the time we've got about 600 dogs for all the time. There's always generally about 600 dogs, about 200 cats.
Yeah.
2 days ago we had to shut the rescue centre at Wacol because we ran out of pets.
Wow.
Never happened. They weren't all adopted. They've all been fostered. But the thing is, when I was at the RSPCA back in 2011, when the floods hit, the reason why they built the new big one out at Wacol is because Fairfield, which is just around the corner from me here, Fairfield went underwater.
Okay.
So all the dogs, everything went underwater there. So they basically said, look, we don't have anywhere to put them. We need everyone to come and foster these. We had the biggest line you've ever seen the next morning out the front. They were all fostered that day. And 95% of them were then adopted by the foster parent. And that was after 4 or 5 days. They only needed them looked after 4 or 5 days. It's going to be six to 18 months that people are going to be fostering these dogs. Do you think any of them are going to give that dog back?
No.
Nope. They're all adopted, those dogs. And as far as I'm concerned, they're adopted.
So then what are the benefits you think people are going to see by having these pets in their lives?
So pet in your life gives you 5 to 6 years of life, extra life.
Gotcha.
If you have a pet, especially if you have a pet from when you're a small child, the improvements in immunity that you have that will reflect on your immune system for the rest of your life and keep you alive for a hell of a lot longer than you should be is because of your pet. That's why farm kids are always the most stoic children. They've got chickens, they've got cows, they've got dogs and cats. Their immune system is phenomenal. And then you add the mental health on top of that. And I sit there and go, how much value do you put on 6 years of your life? Like, what monetary value would you put on 6 years of living on the planet? Mm. Yeah, that's what your dog is worth. That's what your cat is worth to you.
And I think that then comes down to we all love our pets. We'd all do anything for our pets. And then I think it's got to come back to almost a public service announcement of going, no, we have to respect and treat with respect and recognize the value of the vets.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
So, it's got to come back full circle. You can't have one without the other. You can't sort of say, I love my pet, but I'm going to completely disregard and disrespect those who devote their lives to taking care of our pets. And I think we've covered a lot today in terms of the value and the stresses of vets, and that they deserve, and you deserve, like so much more respect and kindness, because if you're operating at a healthy, emotionally well-rounded, mentally healthy life, you're going to take better care of my beloved pets.
Yes.
If you're burnt out, financially stressed and abused every which way, then Harry's not going to feel
the No. And the other thing is, like, even just in clinic, like dogs especially, a lot of their stuff is facial recognition. So if a vet or a nurse walks in and has just had someone abuse the hell out of her, a dog picks up on that instantaneously.
Yes.
And that affects their mental health and their recovery time.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that is a scientific fact. But dogs pick up on that very quickly.
Yeah.
Because that's just how they read things. Your facial expression is what dogs pick up on. Absolutely. And they pick up on, like, nuances in facial expression are picked up by dogs 1,000 times better than they are people.
Yeah.
And it affects them. So we have what's called the five freedoms in animal health. And they're like the five basics of life that every animal has to be afforded. And one of them is, you know, like a good mental place. Freedom from hunger and thirst.
Yep.
Freedom from discomfort. Yep. Freedom from pain, injury, and disease. The big one, freedom to express normal behaviors. And the other one that people don't realize, number five, is the freedom from fear and distress.
Yes.
A dog seeing you distressed distresses the dog. The most empathetic animal on the planet is a dog.
Oh, completely.
Yeah, like they know when you're upset. That's why they come up to you, and that's why they use them as support animals. That's why they, you know, for people who have, you know, aspersions or panic attacks or something, because they are the most empathetic animal on the planet.
Oh, and PTSD dogs.
Yep. Oh, yeah. And that's why I say that freedom from fear and distress is so important, because that is actually hearing the argument, having people walk in, upset, distressed, those sorts of things, that affects your dog's recovery time. Yeah, in a huge way, not a little way, a huge way. We can't be as good as we need to be if we're dealing with people. We can't do what we're trained to do, which is deal with animals, because we're dealing with people. You're taking up our time. You're taking up our mental health. You're taking up our financial time. You take it like all these sorts of things where it's, I just want to help your dog, and I'm just trying to do the best to help your dog. No vet has a bumper sticker on their car that says, I do it for the money. There is not a single vet. I do not know a single vet out there who went, yeah, I became a vet because cha-ching. Like, yeah, and you'll be really surprised at how many people quit in the first year because they realize how little a vet earns.
So, Evan, if people want to find you, because taking care of our pets, if we want to have the mental health benefits, we have to take care of them. Part of taking care of them is taking care of all their fleas and worms and all those disgusting things we don't even want to think about because we don't want them to get sick. How do people find you? What's the best way to get in contact with you?
The website's Fleamail.
FLEAMAIL.
We send your flea and tick stuff in the mail. So, yeah, well, we just make it a lot easier because in Australia there's a couple of really good statistics about this. 46,000 pets are taken to the vet each month for parasite-related disease. It's the number two reason for taking your dog or cat to the vet is a parasite-related disease. Unfortunately, about 20,000 just from paralysis tick are put down each year, just from paralysis tick.
Gotcha.
There's about 150 parasites that affect your dog or cat. That's one of them. That's about 20,000 a year die. So the big number one thing is 25% of pets in Australia never get any flea, tick, and worming control in their entire life.
Yeah.
Of those that do, 84% only get 7 out of 12 treatments a year. So everyone forgets every time in the clinic when someone comes in with their dog being absolutely destroyed by worms or ticks or anything like that, the number one thing I get is, I forgot.
Yeah.
I forgot this month. It sits in the pantry for God knows how long, and they just go, I forgot. So, yeah, so basically we deliver it to your door each month.
Yeah.
And vets do it for your postcode, so your location, so all the right parasites are covered and all those sorts of things.
Gotcha.
So in Australia also, there is no single product that covers everything.
Okay.
It's very, very, yeah. So everybody thinks, I just give this. And I go, cool, so what are you doing about this, 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 and this? They go, no, I've just got to give this. I'm like, nope. Gotcha. There is no silver bullet in Australia. Australia is nasty animal central. We all know that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like we're the only country that has the ferocity of paralysis tick we do. They do exist in other countries, but they have nothing like the venom that we do in Australia in the paralysis tip here. And that kills dogs and cats. One-stop shop, it's a lot cheaper than going to a pet store or a vet clinic. It's simple, you know, like monthly deduction. Every month it arrives at your door. When the blue pack arrives, you give it to your pet. So everything's taken care of. So you don't have to think about it. You don't have to worry about, I give this one once a month, this one every 2 months, this one every three. It's like, nah, that's all taken care of. Just blue pack will arrive addressed to your dog. And
so you don't get your dogs mixed up?
No, that's the thing. So each individual pet you have in your home will have its own little pack with their name on it, their treatments in it, their own sort of thing. So, and that's all it is, just open a little bag. They're all edibles for dogs, all spot on for cats. So easy to administer. We've done all the testing on like what they like the most, which ones work the best, the longest, which are the safest, all that stuff. We've done all that. So we only use the best stuff, and most of us also Australian made and everything as well. So we try to keep it here. From every pet, we also donate every month. We donate $1 to an Australian rescue organisation.
Oh, lovely!
Well, that's my thing. I know how much all my rescues run on like an oily rag.
Yeah.
There's no money in it. You know, there's no grants. There's no government money. The RSPCA gets $250,000 a year from the Australian government. That's it.
Yeah,
that's all they get. Everyone thinks, oh, it's government. Rah. I'm like, no, no, no. $250,000 from the government once. That's for the entire of Australia. For the millions of homeless pets that are in Australia, $250,000 to run the RSPCA. A lot of that stuff is, you know, oily rag stuff. There's a lot of animals that get dumped and those sorts of things. I love my rescues, so that's our sort of. We've got a whole bunch of rescues all around Australia that we donate to. People can actually sign up through the rescues, so they get, you know, like residual income through flea mail and things like that. So yeah, we think we're helping a lot of pets and a lot of people. So yeah, just making stuff easier is. Awesome. Yeah, I feel really happy about that. I'm like, hey, there's 10,000 dogs and cats out there who are my members.
Yeah.
Who will never go to the vet clinic again for a parasite related disease.
Yeah.
And that's a good place that I can rest my head, I think. Like I just like that's a lot better than I can do working in the clinic.
Yeah.
Like I can do that absolutely. Every month and stuff. I can see maybe 250 animals in a clinic.
Yeah.
In a month. With this, I can look after, make sure that, you know, 10, you know, at the moment we've got like just over 10,000 members.
Yeah.
10,000 dogs and cats in Australia. Never have to worry about it every day.
Yeah. Well, it should be 10,001. I'm going to go and sign Harry.
Oh, sweet. Awesome.
All right.
Your first month's $5.
Woohoo! Champion. Thank you so much for this. I'm going to wrap this up. And
cool.
Thank you so much for our chat today.
Not too easy.
It's been really good.
Yeah, it's a very not spoken about industry.
Yeah.
It's a very, this is what it looks like on the surface. Scratch away at the top of it and like, whoa.
Whoa.
This is not what the pamphlet mentioned.
Oh, thank you so much.
It's all good, mate.
I'll talk to you
pleasure.
Soon.
I love doing these things. So yeah. anytime you got any of these questions or any stuff like that, yeah, I can do a lot of podcasts now. So
yeah.
I got mountains of useless, crappy information in me.
Thank you.
All right, mate. No worries. Have a good one. All right.
Bye.
Thank you so much, Dr. Evan Shaw. Evan, that was just beautiful. And I really took a lot away about how to support people who become veterinarians, but also why people become veterinarians and what passion and drive is behind that and the struggles and pressures that they have to endure in order to give our pets the love that they want to give them. Financial pressures, cultural pressures. It was a big discussion and we covered a lot. So thank you so much for staying with me. My name's Leanne Butterworth. This was the Empathy Podcast. And if you would like to reach out, you can find me now at www.empathyfirst, www.empathypodcast.com.au, where you can find our new online training program. All right, I'll talk to you soon. Thanks.